Hey, Nate, I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Feedback. I'm not hearing Vanessa either.
Hey, Nate, can you hear me?
Yes.
Is the PA off?
That's it? Is that as big as I can get it?
Nate, can you hear me?
So Ben decides to do it and then shake it up a little. There's some technical. So we're not moving it. So we're just gonna...
Vanessa, can you hear me?
Nate, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. All right, yeah, you sound good.
Okay, great. I think that we should be good then, as long as no one touches anything on Teams.
Okay, yeah, I had the Teams volume down, so, okay.
Awesome.
I think we're good.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
online, we have Representatives Thompson, Laban, Ortiz, Wool, and Johnson. This afternoon, we will have a third hearing on House Joint Resolution 1, Constitutional Amendment Regarding the Permanent Fund, POMV, and Earnings, by Representative Christ Tompkins. Representative Tompkins is in Juneau in the House Finance Room. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, we can barely hear you.
Testing.
Okay, that's much better.
Great.
Representative Christ Tompkins, if you'd like to reintroduce the resolution and proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Merrick and members of the committee. House Joint Resolution 1 is a relatively simple amendment to the Constitution. It does two things in its present form. The first is that it combines the ERA and the principal into one singular permanent fund. And the second thing is that singular fund is then managed by an unbreakable 5% of market value draw with the same first five of the six preceding year fiscal year smoothing function that we're currently familiar with from the POMV and statute. And that's what it does. And the purpose when I introduced the legislation, well, the last couple of legislatures, is basically to protect the entirety of the permanent fund so that it is there forever. And truly permanent, and that the wealth within the permanent fund is available to future generations.
Thank you, Representative. And I'd like to note we have Alexi Painter, Director of Legislative Finance, and Angela Rodell, CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. They're both online. If the committee has questions, are there any questions? Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Chris Thompson, just for anybody in the public who's watching, regarding constitutional amendments, the requirement to pass those requires the votes of the legislature and the public. Can you just touch on that?
Representative Foster, through the chair, so passage of a constitutional amendment would require a two-thirds supermajority vote in each of the two bodies of the legislature, the House and the Senate, and then only upon achieving the two-thirds supermajority threshold in both bodies would require ratification, a simple majority vote from the public in the next general election, which in this event, should this legislation be passed, this legislature would be November 2022. So it's a very high bar.
Thank you.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would be interested in hearing from Ms. Rodell regarding this resolution and her view of it, if she's willing to share it with us.
Ms. Rodell?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. House Joint Resolution 1 is something that we would support in its entirety. This resolution reflects what the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation had as priority for 20 years now. So the simplicity of it, the fact that it creates an endowment with a percent of market value, the language in this resolution does reflect the priority, and so this is a resolution that we would support wholeheartedly. I would ask that as it moves forward, there are a couple of clarifying amendments to the language that we would suggest, just in terms of timing of some of the dates and things in this particular resolution, but overall, those are just, I would probably put them in the category of cleanup or clarification, and I'm happy to talk about those now, or we can submit those to the committee if that's your desire.
Ms. Rodell, we have a few more questions from the committee. Why don't we get through the queue, and then you can go over the amendments that you're proposing?
Next is Representative Rasmussen. I think my question might be best served with Mr. Painter, if he's on.
Yes, he is.
Do we have any charts or comparisons on how the current statutory draw out of the ERA compares with the 5% draw combining the entire fund? Is there any difference, or is that something that we have information on? Mr. Painter?
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. There would be no difference in the POMV calculation as a result of the change, because currently the POMV calculation incorporates the entire fund.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess this is a question for Ms. Rodell. We heard this bill in Ways and Means, and in its current form, I think it's appealing to a lot of people. It has a certain simplicity and attractiveness for a lot of reasons. But as we heard in Ways and Means and around the building and elsewhere, there's a desire to not only put the 5% draw into the Constitution, but also a PFD formula. And the one of the popular ones is a 50-50, where half of the draw goes to state services and the other half goes to PFD checks. Does this affect, I'll hear it again. Does Ms. Rodell have any, does she or the Permanent Fund Corporation have any preference for what happens to the POMV draw, or you just like that it's limited to 5% and you don't really care what happens to it after it's drawn, as long as it's limited to 5%?
Through the chair, this is Angela Rodell, CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Representative Wohl, you are correct when you state that we are indifferent as to what happens to the 5% once it's drawn out of the fund. So to the extent there's any additional language clarifying that within this, our focus is on the amount, the percentage being drawn out of the fund, that top line number, and that is what we would like to see put into a constitutional amendment.
Okay, thank you. A follow-up, please.
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate that, and I certainly understand where you're coming from. I guess many of us also have the concern, and I suppose if it's in the Constitution, then we don't. The concern might go away that if 50% is paid out in PFD checks, then the remaining 50% of the POMV draw wouldn't be sufficient for the government services that many people have become accustomed to, and therefore. Overdraw would be a fear, but I guess if it's locked into the Constitution, the overdraw factor would be taken away, and then added revenue in the form of taxes would have to sort of fill the void. And I guess maybe that's a question for the bill sponsor, that would sort of be the obvious result. If there wasn't enough for state services, we would just have to find more money to pay for services, since the POMV draw would be basically part of it partitioned into PFD checks. And if the bill sponsor could elaborate on his feeling of attaching a formula to the constitutional amendment and how he feels about that.
Representative Price Tompkins.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wohl. I'm open to this piece of legislation, HJR 1, being a vehicle for a broader compromise to the fiscal problem, including any amendments or revisions, including substantive amendments and revisions beyond the present language. I think there's a couple of different options to what you're speaking to, Representative Wohl. There's putting, an actual specific formula into the Constitution, and just speaking personally, I'm pretty cautious about that. There's another possibility that has been discussed as far as providing certainty on the PFD question, which is putting language into the Constitution that guarantees the formula as provided by law, and then the formula remains in statute. I have comparatively more comfort with that approach, but broadly speaking, you know, if there's a will to answer some of the problems that have been bedeviling the legislature and the state at large over the last better part of a decade, and there's a way to put some of them to bed, I mean, I'd be open to this legislation being a vehicle for that, including addressing the PFD question in some form or fashion.
Thank you. One last follow-up, please, if I may.
Yes, Representative Wool.
Thank you. Speaking of constitutional amendments and the Constitution, are there any other items in the Constitution that specify a dollar amount or a formula, such as education funding or anything like that? Is there anything else that spells out how much money should go to a certain program or budget item? And this, if a PFD formula were put in there, that would prioritize that appropriation over anything else in the budget. Is that correct?
I assume that question's for me, Representative Wool, through the chair. Your question presupposes that there's a proposal to put a specific formula in the Constitution, which is not a proposal in front of us right now, nor one I personally am that crazy about. But to run with the thrust of your question, no, there's not any specific, you know, financial formulas in the Constitution at present that I'm aware of. The somewhat less prescriptive as provided by law approach feels like it'd be a little bit more consistent to other provisions in the Constitution that provide more flexibility as the state evolves, as the legislature and sort of government reacts to changing circumstances.
Thank you. But I think if there was a provision that said as provided by law, it would still prioritize that over other budget items, as I understand it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bolt. In the queue, we have Representatives Ortiz, Lebon, Rasmussen, and Carpenter. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. A question, I believe, both for both participants that are at the table today from the working group, Representative Carpenter, as well as Representative Price-Tompkins, would both of you care, would either of you or both care to articulate what the consensus position is on the resolution that's currently being offered by Representative Price-Tompkins? What's the consensus of position on the resolution as it stands? If you could do that for me, please. Thanks.
Representative Price-Tompkins, and then Carpenter, if you have comments. Representative Price-Tompkins.
Sure.
Put Thompson in the queue.
Thanks for the question, Representative Ortiz, through the chair, and of course, welcome any corrections or additions by Representative Carpenter. One of the working group recommendations was to have the permanent fund in an endowment structure with a constitutional POMV. That recommendation is reflected by the current language of HCR 1. However, there's a sort of meta recommendation that, you know, none of the single policy recommendations really stand on their own because there won't be the political support for passing them. And as the sponsor of HCR 1, I can tell you I don't think there's the political support for this to pass the legislature. Therefore, it's just sort of a rearrange of the deck chairs faffing around situation right now. So in order for this particular provision to have a chance of passing politically and therefore, you know, following through on the recommendation, there probably needs to be a broader comprehensive approach, which then relates to a whole bunch of other things that aren't reflected in HDR 1, including revenues, including certainty on the dividend question, including other issues. So I think that's just as relevant as the working group recommendation on a constitutional PMV and a single fund structure for the permanent fund. But of course, Representative Carpenter may correct me or have additional thoughts or comments.
Representative Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think Representative Price-Thompson summed it up pretty good. I don't have anything more to add.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I guess I'd like to go back to Ms. Rodell and also for the benefit of the listening audience, maybe talk about how unusual it was for our endowment, known as the Alaska Permanent Fund, to hold within it an earnings reserve account, and how it's more traditional in the public endowment arena to have just one common fund. And maybe she could just give a little bit more background into why there's a greater advantage to the Alaska Permanent Fund to roll that money together.
Ms. Rodell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Angela Rodell, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. You know, the Permanent Fund constitutional amendment was adopted by the voters 45 years ago, this coming November. It was adopted in a much simpler time from both an investment and an accounting perspective. And the language is actually quite beautifully written, in the sense of it gives us a sense of how to think about constitutional language and the flexibility it gave every generation thereafter in terms of the fund. And it requires that we collect a percentage of our royalty revenue, and that royalty revenue be deposited into the fund. It can only be used for income-producing investments, the income of which shall go to the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. And in 1980, the legislature created the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, moved the management of that fund outside of the Department of Revenue over to the independent entity that is the corporation. And there was a thought at that time that income needed to be collected and held separately from the general fund. The dividend statutes were put in place in their final form, I believe, around 1982 or 1983. And then, and we have operated under that ever since. And what also then happened, though, in that time, is that we went beyond just investing in bonds and collecting cash interest payments and principal payments off those bond investments, to investing in stocks, in real estate, in private equity, in infrastructure, in hedge funds. And current accounting rules require us to mark all of that gain that may happen from market movements. So to the extent that there is an increase in the valuation of an asset, that increase in valuation is defined as income under accounting principles. Now, it's impossible to spend that income without selling the investment and collecting the cash associated with it, which is why the legislature created its definition of statutory net income and requires that statutory net income then flow to the earnings reserve account. So it was the compromise to the constitutional language, the definition of income at that time, to conform to a now current definition of income. But the real value, and the reason I believe that the trustees have been behind a percent of market value classic endowment structure now for 20 years, is that, one, it removes this sort of artificial device in defining income, it allows the fund to fully recognize the increased value over time, and we would no longer be required to ask each year for an inflation-proofing appropriation, because as you might remember, the only way the principal can continue to purchase investments at the same level it did for as 20 years ago is through that inflation-proofing appropriation mechanism. So that would go away. And then probably also equally importantly, it confirms within the Constitution the intergenerational desire that was put forth by the legislature on the fund. And if you our legislative findings around the corporation is to maximize principal, minimize risk, and to ensure that there is revenue for all generations of Alaskans, and the PONV would do that because it would basically create an equitable distribution each year based on the calculation.
Thank you, Ms. Rodell. Representative Rasmussen. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have two questions. I think the first one would be for Mr. Rodell and then one for Mr. Painter. With the permanent fund, I don't know if you have a position on this, but would you be supportive of a one-time overdraw as part of a grander package to pass the PONV in the Constitution and protect it going into the future, just knowing how tight some of our margins are at this point, and it doesn't seem like we have a full plan that'll get us through in the next 2 to 3 years, given how tight the amount of money in the general fund is. Ms. Rodell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Rasmussen, I think what's really important for the sustainability of the fund is to be disciplined around the draws on that fund. And so I think it's really important to understand the full package, understand what is happening and whether or not that one-time draw is truly a one-time draw, because I will confess in my experience that hasn't always been the case. So if you hear hesitation in my voice, it's because of my past history on sort of one-time draws.
Thank you. And then for Mr. Painter, I'm sorry. I was curious if you could explain a little bit about the history or purpose of the various funds that we have, because it seems like as finances get tighter and tighter on the state that everyone's looking to some of the various slush funds, I guess, that they've been traditionally called, and it seems like it would make most sense to put all money into the CDR, I guess, if you will, that the state is bringing in as a way to maximize the investments. And I mean, I've heard that the CDR doesn't make any money. It's not meant to make money, but it seems like poor use of the resources that we have if we're not trying to maximize every dollar that we have at this point. Mr. Painter?
For the record, Alexi Painter, through the Chair, Representative Rasmussen. So of the current funds we have outside of the earnings reserve and permanent fund and then the CBR, the statutory budget reserve was created as a simple majority vote savings account to have in addition to the CBR, which requires a three-quarters vote. Most of the balance had been added during a time when the CBR was, we didn't have a debt to the CBR, so essentially additional savings rather than put into the CBR were put into the SBR. This last year is refilled, and that, I guess, would be more of a policy choice by the legislature to put money in there. Other accounts that we have are mostly designated for particular purposes. For example, the PCE fund or the Higher Education Investment Fund were set up by the legislature to as a source of ongoing support for programs. so these larger endowment funds like that, the legislature made a policy choice that these programs needed a designated source of revenue and set aside the money for the future. The remainder of our funds are primarily sort of ongoing expenses or, you know, fund balance built up in a fund for a designated tax. So, for example, the alcohol and tobacco fund, those funds, in some years, revenue will exceed projections, and so there's an additional balance that stays in the fund, and that fund balance is used to sort of even out the cash flow throughout the year. So those funds are a little separate from the others, but I guess those are created mostly for the purpose of evening out cash flow for these designated purposes. But in general, these designated funds were created by the legislature as a mechanism to support certain programs in an ongoing basis.
I appreciate the explanation. Is there anything that would prohibit the legislature from appropriating money directly from the general fund if all of the funds were moved into the CBR, or I'm sorry, the principal of the fund, the earnings reserve, I can't speak right now, into the permanent fund as one account, if all of the remaining funds were swept into that account, would there be anything prohibiting the legislature appropriating those dollars from the general fund 5% draw that we see every year?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, no, although I would note that because of the lag and the averaging in the percent of market value draw, if you, let's say, deposit $1 billion today into the permanent fund, that will not impact your POMV in the next year, and it will only have a partial impact in the following year. So in the short term, that move would increase your budget deficits, but in the long term, it would essentially balance out.
Thank you. Mr. Painter, this is Representative Merrick. For the public, could you just explain the difference between designated and dedicated funds?
Yes, to the chair. So we distinguish between a dedicated fund, which is a fund that cannot be spent outside the purposes that are set out either in the Constitution or, in one case, in our statehood compact, in the case of the Public School Trust Fund, when Congress made us a state, that fund was part of that statehood act. And those are true dedications are provisions that we cannot break through the appropriations process. Designations are statutory provisions that indicate a past legislature's intent that a fund is spent a certain way, but those are always subject to appropriation. So a past legislature may have intended for one half of alcohol revenue to go towards treatment and recovery programs, but that's subject to appropriation by future legislatures, unlike the dedicated funds.
Thank you, Mr. Painter. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So going back to Representative Wohl and Representative Christ-Tompkins' dialogue, it seems like a long time ago, asking a question about formulas in the Constitution, and I would just like to point to the language that exists within this bill. Within this resolution, and also exists within the Constitution, of at least 25% of all royalties going into the permanent fund. So there is some, there is precedent, there is example of how the Constitution does work with regard to setting percentages and making something happen with the dollars that our state deals with. Incidentally, the statutory additional 25% that is supposed to go into the permanent fund is been followed most years, with the exception of, as noted by our chief auditor, that there were a couple of years that we did not follow the statute and put the additional 25% into the permanent fund. But to the best of my knowledge, the statutory formula has always been followed by the state in putting royalties from the oil industry into the permanent fund. So if that's helpful to the body and to the public to keep that in mind. I would also like to get a clarification from Ms. Rodell, if possible, regarding the balance of the ERA. There is a dialogue that's happened thus far today that paints a picture that the permanent fund has grown because we've put oil royalties and other sums into the fund and allowed it to grow, which is true and I have no argument about. But the current balance of the ERA, which is kind of the crux of this amendment and other discussions that are going on, is to move the ERA balance into the what we would understand as the corpus of the fund that can't be touched currently. How did the current balance of the ERA come to exist? Was it because we put oil royalties into it? Or other investment earnings into it? How did it come to exist? And why do we have such a large balance today?
Ms. Rodell? Thank you for the record, Angela Rodell, Alaska Permanent Fund, through the chair, Representative Carpenter. The earnings reserve account can only grow through the investment decisions made by the corporation. So to the extent that, to your question about how has it become so large, it's a combination of things. One is that each year the amount available for appropriation was not used, it was left behind. It remained fully invested with the principal of the fund. But then in terms of how it grows in addition to just the market value of the investment, the earnings reserve account can only grow by realizing gains, by rebalancing, by collecting cash, by collecting rentals off of real estate, by collecting interest off of bonds, by collecting dividends off of stock. So that money continues, all that statutory net income continues to build. It stays fully invested, so it grows through both the market valuation as well as the usage over the years by various legislatures. As of July 31st, the balance in the earnings reserve account was $13.1 billion. Of that $13.1 billion, $3.4 billion has been earmarked as committed for the FY23 POMV. $3 billion are unrealized gains, leaving a balance of $6.7 billion uncommitted and available for future appropriation. We will have August 31 numbers later this month. It usually takes us a good 3 weeks to reconcile and do all the monthly reconciliations in order to determine what the balance is.
Representative Carpenter, anything further?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Rodell. The fiscal year 23 POMB earmark of $3.4 billion that you said remains or is currently in the ERA, that $3.4 billion is not just funds of the ERA, but that is would be a representative of 5% of the total fund value. Is that a correct statement?
It is the five-year average, because we've closed our book now on FY21. It's the full value of fund assets, so it's principal plus earnings reserve account balance. It's the average of that number times 5%.
So another follow-up. Thank you.
Yeah, follow-up.
Does the earnings reserve account balance grow when the income deposited into it annually by the permanent fund because of this five-year look-back 5% draw is not appropriated or partially appropriated by the legislature.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think I understand your question, but so if, for example, if what you're suggesting is, let's assume that 1 year you only decided to appropriate $1.5 billion rather than the $3.4 billion under the calculation, the difference between those two would remain in the earnings reserve account, would continue to stay fully invested in the full asset allocation of the fund, continue to increase, hopefully, that the market, you know, assuming that the market doesn't have substantial losses, and then be available to be included in future calculations that could result in a higher POMB calculation in a future year.
Thank you. A follow-up.
Yes, follow-up?
I'm going to ask my question again about the balance of the ERA and how it came to exist. Is it not true, or is it true, that portions of the income deposited into the account over the last few years, over several years, where income was deposited into the account and not appropriated by the legislature, and thus growing the size of the earnings reserve account, is that a true statement?
So if, through the chair, is it a truth? So the POMB came into place in 2018. Are you talking about prior to implementation of the POMB? Because prior to the implementation of the POMB, all that was ever drawn out of the statutory, or all that was drawn out of the earnings reserve account was the amount for the dividend under a completely different basis. So those, that calculation is based on income, not on market value. And all that was drawn out was the amount for the dividend. And then there were amounts each year transferred from the earnings reserve account to the principal associated with inflation proofing. So, when we say that there are amounts of statutory net income left behind in the earnings reserve account, yes, there was. It was allowed to grow, but, you know, we had a year like 2009 where we had net losses that really counted against that. So, you know, it kind of depends on what we're talking about here.
Follow up, please.
Representative Carpenter.
So I never asked in my question, and my question didn't have anything to do with the POMB. My question was in regards to the balance of the ERA and how it came to exist. And so I feel like I'm going around in circles here trying to get the answer that I want to point out here. Statutory net income is what what the state and the people would recognize as the traditional formula for how you define what the amount of the earnings is going to be used towards a permanent fund dividend. And there were a number of years where that statutory net income was deposited into the earnings reserve account, and then only a portion of the statutory number was paid out in dividend, leaving remaining a portion of the statutory net income, leaving it in the ERA. Thus, the ERA grew because the statutory net income was not paid out as it was directed by statute. Legislature chose not to do it. Is that not a correct statement?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that is a correct statement. I would just also add to that statement, though, there were investment decisions that have been made over the years that substantially increased statutory net income in certain years. For example, in certain years, like where we sold a multifamily holding that resulted in a huge realized gain, flowing a lot of statutory net income in. But you are absolutely correct that the legislature did not use the entire earnings reserve account year over year. They left balances behind.
One follow-up.
Last follow-up.
I think it's important that when we discuss the permanent fund and we say that the only way that this fund grows is by putting money into it, that is a true statement, whether it's oil royalties or whether it's some other appropriation by the legislature. But when we're talking about the earnings reserve account and what is spendable, that is not just money that was either appropriated into the fund from some other source or from royalties from the oil wealth. That ERA balance that is there now that is spendable is a balance that exists because we chose not to follow the statute and leave money in the earnings reserve account. And therefore, a portion of the permanent fund, that portion that exists in the earnings reserve account that was not paid out by statute, is only there because we chose not to spend it on a permanent fund dividend, and we invested it instead. And thus, spending it down now is no different than paying a permanent fund dividend per the statute a number of years ago, with the exception that the interest we earned off of it over the preceding years, or the after, you know, in the last few years, wouldn't be there as well.
Mr. O'Dell, do you have a comment?
I don't think I have any. I don't think there's a question or anything for me to add. That's a policy call for the legislature as to how money gets spent out of its reserve account.
Thank you. Next up, we have Representatives Thompson, Ortiz, and Josephson. Representative Thompson.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
I just had a question about inflation proofing, and how much was the inflation proofing figure for this year, Ms. Rodell?
Through the chair, I believe it came to, and Pauline is looking for me right now, but I believe it came to slightly over between 500 and $600 million. Now, it was not appropriated, and the language in the $4 billion transfer from FY20 would have the intent was that $4 billion would forward fund inflation proofing. But I know we did do the calculation for this year. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. And we can circle back and get that to you and the members of the committee.
The $4 billion transfer more than covers a few years of inflation proofing, I assume. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, just as a reminder, the inflation proofing is only calculated on the principal balance, not the entire fund, but just what's in the principal. It's a calendar year inflation calculation. And so the rate for FY21, it would have been $577 million, and it was an inflation rate of 1.23%. And so if you expect inflation to go up substantially over the next couple of years, you'll see that number grow. And in fact, because money has moved into the principal of the account, there's a bigger base on the calculation as well.
Okay, a follow-up question?
Yes, Representative Thompson.
I don't know who this would go to, but say that we did put in a formula for the PFD, let's say if it was a 50-50 split, would inflation proofing come out of the original 5% draw before being split up between the operating and PFD, or would it just come out of the operating side? I don't know.
I can take that, Madam Chair, if you like.
Yes.
Representative Thompson, there would no longer be, under the POMV constitutional amendment, there would no longer be a need to have an inflation proofing because it would eliminate the two-account structure, and inflation would be automatically accounted for in the overall market value of the fund. The challenge we have now is that the principal doesn't get to hold on to any of that market value gain, and so it loses all of its inflation-adjusted gain as well, because it can only capture its cost basis. So once you eliminate that two-account structure, you also eliminate the need to do inflation proofing.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all I have right now.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It's my understanding and that both the working group as well as I know the governor and probably other groups as well have spoken about the need to put into our Constitution a revised spending cap. My question would be, I guess it would start with Mr. Painter, but then if Representative Price Tompkins and or Representative Carpenter want to weigh in, they can do that as well. If we were to adopt SGR 1 as it is, unamended, if we were to do that, would that not in fact be an effective spending cap and thus reduce the need for anything else to be done to the Constitution in that way?
Mr. Painter?
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance. Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I don't know that I can speak for the administration, but the OMB director testified yesterday, I believe, to the other body's finance committee that the administration still believes that a spending cap would be necessary to address times with oil prices happen to spike again, that there would be sufficient revenue, that having a constitutionalized POMV would not be an effective spending cap because there would be additional revenue. So that was the position of the administration as of yesterday, but I can't speak beyond that.
Representative Price Tompkins?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, certainly nothing to add in terms of the administration's perspective beyond what Mr. Painter said, and of course I don't represent the administration. I can sort of speak personally. I can also say what the working group report says. You know, personally, I am not kept up at night by the lack of revisions to Alaska's current spending limits, and I think in many ways what HGR 1 in its present form represents is a revenue limit, and given that this is the preponderance of revenue that the state of Alaska currently receives, a revenue limit largely equates and affects to a expenditure limit as well. So I think for many, although not all intents and purposes, a revenue limit and a constitutional POMV will substantially restrain spending. Of course, there is a hypothetical that other non-permanent fund related revenue sources spike unexpectedly because of volatility or whatever, and it's that scenario that some might say a expenditure limit is important. But as I said, personally speaking, it's not something that I have nightmares about when I sleep. As far as the working group report, it was a recommendation that the spending limits be revisited and revised, and my personal perspective is if that is a piece that helps us get to a broader solution, then I can I'm find a way to get behind that.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you, Representative Ortiz, for the question and dialogue opportunity here. So I'm in agreement with you on the concept of the POMB draw being a spending limit on the source of income from the permanent fund, but it does not do anything with regards to royalties that come into the state. And by constitution, only 25% of the entire royalties, oil royalties, come into the state have to be done something with constitutionally, right? Those 25% have to be put into the permanent fund. So then there's 75% of the royalties, assuming we ignore the statute that says an additional 25% needs to go into the permanent fund. Both of those two things would be spending caps or spending limits of the way, because now it says that only 50% of the royalties coming into the state from oil can go into the general fund and be spent. So unless we put 100% of our oil royalties and 100% of our corporate income taxes and 100% of all the other fees and taxes that we collect every year into the permanent fund and then only draw out of the fund 5%, that's the only way that you would end up with the 5% being an effective spending cap on the amount of money that's available to the state. So I don't see that happening, but that would be in using the structure of this resolution as a spending cap. That would be what would be necessary, is we would just have to throw all of the revenue the state gets into the permanent fund and then only draw out 5%.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Anything further, Representative Ortiz?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, first for Mr. Painter. Mr. Painter, I want to take you back to a hearing you, I think, presented before the Senate Finance, I'm going to say, 2 days ago. And to the extent you can remember, of the $82 billion that exists now that we call the permanent fund, how much has been put in since 1977 that constitutes 25% of royalty? Maybe that Ms. Rodell knows that also.
Mr. Painter?
If through the chair, Representative Justin, if Ms. Rodell has that in front of her, she can answer. Otherwise, I can answer momentarily.
Ms. Rodell?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't have a breakdown in royalty between the 25 and the 50%. All I can speak to is how much royalty has been deposited into the fund since inception, and that's slightly over $18 billion.
All right. Follow up? So, and this is just one argument made by some very fine Alaskan people. I'm not dismissing the argument, just trying to understand it. To the extent the PFD is connected to royalty, and I'm sure there are very variables, $18 of $82 billion would be the constitutionally required royalty portion of what exists today. Is that right?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. I want to next, if I can follow up.
Yes, follow up.
There was a question from Representative Rasmussen about a perceived benefit to simply let funds, not incidental funds, but sort of some of the sub-funds move into the CBR. Representative Drummond made a convincing case. She's done it for a couple months now, that the Higher Education Investment Fund, for example, this year, and this may be more of a Mr. Painter question, has earned over 20%. And my understanding is the CBR is essentially like a 2% fund. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, currently, yes, the CBR is invested to earn about 2% per year.
Follow up?
Yes, follow-up?
So, I mean, it's sort of obvious, I guess, but the Higher Education Investment Fund would be poorer if it didn't exist and those monies were held by the CBR. That sounds like what you're saying. Is that right?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, yes, and, you know, that's because of the different cash needs of the CBR. If we had a balanced budget, for example, and the CBR did not need to be used for cash flow, then the CBR could be invested more aggressively than it is presently.
Representative Josephson.
Talk to Ms. Riddell about inflation proofing. You said, and I think I understand why, that if this amendment or resolution were law, that is part of the Constitution, we wouldn't need inflation proofing. The sense I would get is that we could then repeal those statutes. But my question, and I'm not trying to write a narrative with this question because I don't know the answer, but if the permanent fund only earned 2% in a year and inflation was 5%, wouldn't we want to cover that other 3%? In other words, wouldn't inflation still be the thief in the dark?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think the way to think about it, if I can just sort of do a math in the air illustration, is that currently, I think the best asset to use is a multifamily rental complex. Real estate tends to hold its value through inflationary times. So, and they're long-term investments. So we buy a multifamily complex, and it costs a dollar. And 60 cents or 75 cents of that dollar comes from the principal, and 25 cents comes from the earnings reserve account to buy that multifamily complex. The way it works today is if we go then, and 20 years from now, we sell that same complex for $10, the principal is only going to get back its 75 cents that it put in. And the earnings reserve account is going to get $9.25 from that sale. But now real estate costs $10. So how do you buy an equivalent real estate scheme with your 75 cents in the principal? But if we go to a POMV endowment as envisioned by this constitutional amendment, I would now buy a dollar with the permanent fund, and it would be a full dollar. And when we get to 20 years from now and sell it, I get $10 back. And over the course of time, as that growing and getting higher and higher in market value, the state is getting 5% off of that on an average value to spend against that in terms of annual revenue available for appropriation. But the fund has captured that full inflationary benefit by the increased market value.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I think that there was a misstatement here that we need to correct for the record. Ms. Riddell said that there was $18 billion of total royalty payments made to the permanent fund since we've been making royalty payments. And that has to include the 25% statutory requirement and the 25% constitutional requirement. Going to be a total dollar figure, so it cannot represent just the or the constitutional requirement, and I think that is accurate.
Ms. Riddell?
Through the chair, yes, I believe I did state for the record I did not know the individual components. All I knew was the total amount of royalties that had been deposited, and that was $18
billion. Thank you.
Roughly. It's a little slightly more than that.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
I mean, I think that supports my position, possibly, although I didn't state it, but I implied it. If we didn't have the statute, the extra 25%, my understanding is there's a dispute about this within our own internal agencies, but we clearly must pay the 25%. Paying the other 25% is less clear. The amount, if it's $18 billion for both items, it must be less than that for simply the constitutionally required portion. Am I right?
Through the chair, yes, you are correct.
And, all right, thank you.
Anything further? Questions from the committee? Anyone online? Hearing none, Ms. Rodell, if you would like to talk about the amendment proposals that you discussed earlier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We just have two suggestions for the committee's consideration. The first would be in Section 2C, as in Charlie. The current language reads that the permanent fund may be used to pay costs associated with investments made under A of this section. We would respectfully request that we put a little bit more clarification in this language to make it clear that it can be used for the management and investment. For example, currently the corporation's budget is funded out of the earnings reserve account. Any money not used to manage the fund then lapses back into the earnings reserve account. It could be construed, one could make the argument that this means that the corporation now requires general funds to manage the fund, and so we would want to make sure that we can continue as we have for the last 40 years to use the permanent fund as the source for managing and investing the fund. The second suggestion we have is in Section 3. It calls for a couple of dates so that on June 30th, 2023, an amount equal to the unencumbered balance on November 8th, 2022 of the earnings reserve account shall be deposited. We are only able to reconcile our balances on a monthly basis. It really is impossible for us to compute an accurate balance other than on a month end. So we would suggest that you make this November 8th date a month end date. And you might want to give some consideration about having two different time frames referenced and what happens to both the unencumbered balance and the value of the earnings reserve account in the time period between those marks. So now, in other words, if the mark is November 30th and then the deposit is June 30th, you could have a lot of market volatility that happens within that time frame that you haven't taken into consideration. And so arguably it would seem that the amount on the transfer date should be just any unencumbered balance remaining in the earnings reserve account. And that would avoid any fluctuations in the value rather than having these separate dates that could create a conflict in the amount. And those are the two comments we had to this resolution, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And Representative Christ Tompkins, as the sponsor of this, are you in agreement with those two amendments?
Madam Co-Chair, going in reverse order, I'm supportive of the second revision. That's a technical mishap that should be corrected. And on the first, given available information, I'm also supportive.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Josephson.
And this isn't going to be perfect because I don't have the skill set as of these two good and fine employees, state employees, but you know, I look at subsection C, and I know that this would become dedicated if it passed because it's part of an amendment. And so that qualifies as dedicated. But it sort of spoke to me in terms of the importance of designated general funds, because if this were statutory, in effect, we're saying we want, again, I could be wrong, but I think I'm on to, we want certain funds designated for the operation and maintenance of an institution. We don't want those to go in the CBR. We don't want to talk about them at great length every year. We don't want them to compete with every other program. We know that we need certain funds for the permanent fund, and we're going to say that, that there's a strong presumption that we could sell off the permanent fund building. I don't want to do that. But we know there's a strong presumption that they need it and that it belongs there so they can operate, and we don't have to discuss it every year. I think that this subsection C, although it would become dedicated, is illustrative of why we have designated general funds and why they some get swept and they need to be unswept. Thank you.
Mr. Painter, do you have a comment on that?
Sir, no, I do not.
Representative Carpenter.
I guess I would just like to follow up on what the Representative Josephson was talking about. It makes complete sense to me, and I would like to understand better what the what encompasses the word management in regards to what Ms. Rodell was her recommendation. Does management mean those fees and monies that are required to make investments or to recoup that money, lawyers' fees, whatever, or is that management operations of the corporation? I see the two as separate things, and I would like to understand what she meant by management.
Ms. Rodell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The way this language is currently written, it could be interpreted to only that the fund can only be used to pay the cost basis of an investment. And so management means everything from paying external managers to manage an investment or paying for corporate expenses to manage an investment. But it's all of those things combined, because we manage and invest directly almost 45% of the fund today. So it includes all of it, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I guess I think I'm in agreement with Representative Josephson, which might be a first. I'm not sure. But
we will take note.
But if we're talking about permanent fund corporation cost, operate, then I think that needs to be an annual discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if Mr. Painter had a total balance, like how much money is in all state accounts combined, CBR, the SBR, the PC, the Higher Education Fund. How much money does the state have in every account outside of the permanent fund in totality?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, so if we also exclude retirement accounts, then the value, including Jafonzi funds, which are often kind of not necessarily spendable because they're ongoing, I don't want to try to give you a number off the top of my head. I can get back to the committee with a more precise number.
Follow-up? Just a quick follow-up. When you mentioned, I guess, on the non-spendable ongoing expenses, is there anything prohibiting those accounts being transferred and coming out of the general fund account?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, a lot of the funds in Jafonzi are already obligated. They represent items such as capital projects that have been appropriated, but the project is ongoing. So we have the cash still, but we would have to repeal the underlying appropriation to get at the funds. So I don't know that those are really available for appropriation necessarily, because without going back and repealing a lot of half-finished capital projects and things like that. So also to FONSI, and many of those funds are, for example, the International Airport Fund. By federal law, we cannot spend that on general government. That the international airports, you know, that money has to remain with the airports. Or other funds like the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Investment Fund that has $200 million, that has to, by the terms of the settlement, remain with the, for the purposes of that settlement. Similarly with the Mental Health Trust that, you know, is another sizable fund of the state. You know, these funds are under kind of legal obligation to a particular purpose. So when you get to the designated funds only, really that's the sweepable funds. And we would estimate that between the PCE fund, which is about $1 billion, the CBR, which currently is about $1 billion, and then all the sweepable funds combined from the, you know, the SBR, if that's sweepable, the Higher Education Investment Fund, and others, those would perhaps be another billion, so perhaps $3 billion between all three funds. Again, you know, those designated funds support ongoing appropriations, so sweeping them to the CBR would increase the deficit significantly.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Anyone online? Hearing none. Mr. O'Dell, do you have any closing comments?
No, I don't. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being with us. And Representative Price Tompkins, any closing comments?
No closing comments. Thank you.
Great. Thank you both for being here. I appreciate the committee's time. I would like to recognize that Representative Foster has a staff member, Patrick Fitzgerald. It's his last day with us. And we would like to thank him for all his hard work throughout this session, and we really appreciate all he's done for the Finance Committee. Okay, seeing nothing else to come before the committee, our next meeting is scheduled for Monday, September 13th at 1:30 p.m., where we will hear an introduction of House Bill 189 by the House Ways and Means Committee. And with that, at 4:47 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.